I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Open the pod bay doors now.
I'm sorry, Dan. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the most you ever lost in the contest?
Go ahead. Make my day.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this latest episode of Black Hole Cinema with myself, Tony Black, hosting this week. Dan Taylor has taken a week off. Actually, he'll be off next week as well. He's having a bit of a rest, otherwise known as going out and partying in Devon, like the young whippersnapper he is. So I'm left to host today, which is a nice change. And with me, I have a solo guest today, and that's the ever legendary Mr. Leslie Byron Pitt. Hello, sir.
How you doing? You right?
Yes, I'm fine. You're a bit worse for wear, I believe.
Well, yes, indeed. We are recording just after I've come back from a friend's stag do. So to say a little bit worse for wear is to say the least.
Well, it sounds like a good night, to be fair. If that's the case, it's got to be done. It's got to be done. Today, we're going to discuss just four films for your delectation. We're going to be talking about Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella, as Les has seen that. And we're going to be discussing Sergei Bodrov's Seventh Son, which is the adaptation of A Spook's Apprentice, the Spook's Apprentice, the well-known series of books. We've also got Get Hard, the new Will Ferrell, Kevin Hart combo, which is interesting enough, so to speak. And we have John Wright's little British sci-fi film, Robot Overlords, which I've had a look at. So, and we're going to have a little bit of discussion about another few things in between. But let's start as we mean to go on. I'm going to briefly talk about Seventh Son.
I'm going to leave this place soon.
I knew this day would come. Be wise. Be careful. Everything you ever need is inside you, my son.
I have been searching for you, Mr. Ward. You are the seventh son of a seventh son.
An order of noble knights combating the forces of darkness.
It says here that there are 1,000 of you.
They all died. We are all that's left.
Seventh Son is the adaptation of the novel by Joseph Delaney called The Spook's Apprentice, directed by Sergei Bodrov and starring Jeff Bridges, Alicia Vikander and Julianne Moore, which basically features the story of, set in the medieval times, the story of Thomas Ward, who is a seventh son of a seventh son, and his adventures as he trains to be the apprentice of the Spook, so played by Jeff Bridges. Now, are you familiar with this one, Les? Have you heard of this lately?
Well, I've seen basically in one of the cinemas that's nearby me, there is a massive billboard, and it had Jeff Bridges and Julianne Moore, and I was like, what is this? It looked like a January bargain bin type film that just seemed to, it looks like a thing. It exists. I think that's the only thing I can really say about it.
That's really the best kind of review of this film, really. It exists. It was you know, infamously, it's been on the shelf for something like 2 years. It was made like 2 years ago, and originally it was meant to trigger, I think, a proper franchise for the actual Spooks Apprentice books, which I've not read, but apparently are very, very big, very, very well known. And the idea, obviously, was to launch that in, you know, your Harry Potter stylistics, you know, your Hunger Games and all this, and get it moving and get it off in a franchise. The only problem with that is that they've made a shocking film, right? And it's, they really have. You know, if you look at the poster, it might seem like it's Julianne Moore and Jeff Bridges, and it's like a Big Lebowski reunion or something like that, but... Yuck, lorks a lordy. It's really not. Well, for a start, they don't really get a scene together, or they get barely much of a scene together. So, and they're both playing characters who are just completely so far away from the dude and those guys as you could possibly imagine. This is like, it's just like the most sort of industrial machine style of fantasy movie making you'll ever encounter. There really isn't much to say about it. It's immensely bland for something that's got lots of CGI there, and it's got, you know, two attractive young heroes played by Ben Barnes and Alicia Vikander. And Alicia Vikander as well is actually probably an up-and-coming star, because she was quite good in Ex Machina, as we reviewed, you know, and she's, you know, yeah, she's up-and-coming. But this is just so, so bland, it's untrue. And then you've got Jeff Bridges, who's doing, oh my, his accent in this... Honestly, it is beyond belief. It's he's almost monosyllabic, because he's basically just going, I'm not even exaggerating. That's all he does throughout the film. Right. You're there going,
he does turn up in some rubbish.
He does. It was like in, did you see RIPD?
This is the thing. Much like Seventh Son, every so often you see certain films, and it's not because I go by the a kind of measurement saying, if I had the chance, I had the time and everything, I would watch every film under the sun.
Mm.
Unfortunately, being human, I cannot. So therefore, there are certain things where you do have to, you know, pick your time and. The Jeff Daniels, I'm trying to build an extension for my house films, I kind of ignore.
Yeah.
And this sounds like it's one of them.
Or even Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges. Well,
to be fair, you know.
Bill Paxton, Bill Pullman.
Yeah. They're all the same. They're all Bills. They're all Jeffs. But it's, yeah, exactly. And you're quite right too, really. You know, you've got your head screwed on with that. I, you know, as the maxim goes for this show, I see him, so you don't have to, and you really don't have to see Seventh Son. It's just that really sort of bland, you know, it's got an epic score by Marco Beltrami that's all strings and violins and all this kind of stuff. And it's got, you know, Julianne Moore hamming it up. I'm quite amused at the fact that both the best actress and best actor at this year's Oscars, within a month of each other, have both given their best and possibly worst performances at once. Right, it's quite funny.
But that's the same with Halle Berry with Catwoman and Monsters Ball, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think they were the same year, weren't they?
You do
think. I mean, you know, the thing is with this, it was the whole thing of both of these films, both Seventh Son and Jupiter Ascending, were delayed, and you can't help but think that Eddie Redmayne and Julianne Moore must have both gone, oh shit! It's like, you know, why did they have to release them now? Because Julianne Moore's never terrible, but she just hams it up something stupid, and she's got nothing to work with.
You have to remember as well, you know, you've got these guys that we're watching films that we absolutely love, and you know, you've got Jeff Bridges and you've got Julianne Moore, and like you said, I imagine if I went to watch this, they wouldn't be terrible in the sense of bad actors, but I would turn around and I would imagine it would be something that is really haphazard in its direction of them as actors, as opposed to anything else. I think one thing I've kind of been following and thinking to myself in the last couple of weeks before, you know, since I've last been on our podcast, is the idea of direction. We talk about direction in the sense of, obviously we talk about it visually and everything. That's not really the case. It's putting everything together. It's the management of everyone during pre-production and then after in post-production, as well as, you know, your sort of David Lynch's who've got their visionary aspects to them. And one of the things you realise when you see films like this is you've got producers or executives that are, you know, that are shoving it out as quickly as possible in order to try and make a quick buck or to do whatever. They're overseeing everything. You may have a director that probably not too interested in it, or he got certain ideas and they can't do certain things. And, you know, they're in issues with it. And then they've got a whole, you know, they've got actors who are possibly big personalities or not. Not to say that these guys will give the director and producer issues, but they're big personalities. They do things in a certain way and everything else like that. So, you know, there's a lot of things that go into the mix. And this is not to turn around and say that, you know, Jeff Bridges, you know, if I ever met him, you know, and or anything else like that. But this is not to say that he is being an arsehole. But this is a guy that, you know, he knows his stuff. He knows his stuff on a set, and maybe he's got certain things that he wants to put to the table, and they just haven't worked out in the way that he wants. And I'm basically trying to be not so much a devil's advocate here, but, you know, I think it's so easy for us. We all, you know, in podcasts, not every podcast does it. They love laying into guys. They love laying into films and everything else like that. And it's just one of those things where I'm just going, yeah, but, you know, there's loads of elements into it that may have been an issue. So, you know.
It's a good point because, you know, you're talking about something like this that's basically just fodder for the masses. It's not offensive. You know, it's not the kind of film that is hateful in any way or has been made to, you know, really piss people off or stir up things. And it's just, you know, it's nothing like that. So there's nothing. This kind of film doesn't get you angry. It's just so pointless. You think, well, what was the 100 million spent for? Because there's no creative, you know, interest to this. There's no sort of, there's no technique really. It's just stuff on the screen. It's very boring characters, boring writing. Jeff Bridges just, Jeff Bridges just, you know, gruffing his way through a role. And like you say, for whatever reason, there may have been more on the page or more than the intent that was intended. And let's hope there was. But yeah, it's just the kind of film that it's just not worth your time. It really isn't. It's not exciting enough to be worth it. It's not dramatic enough to be worth it. It's not funny enough to be worth it. It doesn't do anything except exist on a screen.
I mean, the interesting thing that you've mentioned is it's fodder for the masses. That's a great way of describing how a lot of films kind of come to us. But the interesting thing about something like Seventh Son is it's quite obvious to me as someone who, yes, I know I haven't really seen it, but it's coming out in March. And this is quite a dead month.
Yeah, very.
Usually it's quite dead in the first three months. It's got interesting because now we're realizing that January can be a place to push prestige, and February is, you know, usually quite dead. March is quite dead. So it does seem to me that this is a film to try and get stuff out there in order to get stuff out there when they can. Like I kind of mentioned at the beginning, this isn't something for me. This isn't something that I would turn around and go, yeah, I would try and see in any sort of interest. The fantasy genre for me is difficult in the first place. You've got to kind of be kind of placed in it and you've got to have some sort of investment in there. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I think that when you see something like Lord of the Rings, one of the reasons why Lord of the Rings worked is the fans were already up and willing to watch it, and it went beyond that, and it took loads more people in. With something like Seventh Son, I don't know. I always find it difficult. I think this is a kind of Percy Jackson thing, on where these things are still relatively popular and still in the public eye at this moment in time, and it's being put out there because obviously it can be put out there. You've mentioned already that it was made 2 years ago. So why was it delayed?
Well, this is the question. Presumably it was the fact that they knew once they'd made it that there wasn't anything that was going to make any kind of dent. And they just realised, right, well, we can't put this against big films because it's just going to die. And maybe it's just a consequence of the fact that they just really didn't know where to place it. They sat it on the shelf. Who knows? I mean, it's surprising, really, that it hasn't come out in another dead month earlier. I think it was supposed to be December, January 2013 to 2014 when it originally came out. But yeah, it's something that, you know, little kids might mildly be passingly entertained by. But anyone who's looking for any kind of substance or drama or excitement, this isn't it. This isn't worth your time. So, Seventh Son will be out for a few weeks at your local Cineworld Multiplex or Odeon or wherever. So if you are of the mind, check it out.
Join us.
Okay, we're just going to move on. Before we get to another review, we're going to have a quick chat about the first of one of two trailers that came out this week. Funnily enough, it's been quite a big week for big movie trailers in both of a similar genre, actually. But to start off with, we're going to discuss the teaser trailer for the new James Bond film, Spectre.
I always knew death would wear a familiar face, but not yours.
I was at a meeting recently and your name came up.
I'm flattered London is still talking about me.
It wasn't MI6.
You're a kite dancing in a hurricane, Mr. Bond.
Welcome, James. It's been a long time. And finally, here we are.
Spectre. I like saying it like that. Spectre.
I'm gonna be quite honest here. Everyone has lost their shit over this, haven't they?
They really have. I mean, I was just about to say, what did you think of it? Because I watched it and I just thought it was phenomenal. What did you think?
It's a decent teaser trailer for what it is. Mm. I'm not the biggest Bond fan, and this isn't me saying negative things about Bond. I think GoldenEye was an amazing cinematic experience for me when I was 12, because I hit 12. It was a 12 certificate, and going to see it in THX. Yeah, for me, Bond is what you make of it. Your favourite Bond is usually your first Bond that you see.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true.
In terms of actors. So for me, Pierce Brosnan, I've got a soft spot for, and I think he's an underrated Bond. And also, looking at something like Casino Royale, I think Daniel Craig's very good as well. One thing I loved is that they haven't got rid of Quantum of Solace. Mm. I think Quantum of Solace is a very maligned film. I understand why it's got its issues, and yes, there is a moment of incoherence in it, and moments of incoherence in it. But I do think as a revenge film, it works. So the idea that they're trying to bring these things together and just make it a little bit more coherent for someone like Daniel Craig, all up for. I think there is no surprise, and this is why you can tell a teaser trailer works. It has its moments, and everyone's talking, you know, trying to do their shot-on-shot breakdowns, and that's one of the reasons why I hate so many movie blogs. But one thing I absolutely love is when I was watching, after it came out, and I was watching my Twitter feed, everyone was saying the same thing. You're a kite dancing in the hurricane.
Yes, yes, yeah.
That's one of the reasons why we go and watch movies. When you hear a line like that, and it rolls off the tongue well, and I think that's fantastic. It's a cheesy line if it was said badly. Just that moment and how it's placed in the trailer, that's why we go and watch movies.
Absolutely.
It brings you in. And that's one thing. I think Craig is a better Bond than people allow him to be. And I really think this is going to be quite interesting. I was a big fan of Skyfall. I know people that really hate it. Old school Bond fans that really hate it.
Yeah.
And I can understand why. But this is really, really interesting for me anyway. I mean, I'm sure when I watch it, and I'm sure people who have listened to the podcast realize, oh God, this guy just poo-poos on everything.
No.
But it'll be very interesting to see what comes from this. But I'm someone who watches teaser trailers and I go, I'm going to try and watch it once, and then if it's at the cinema, I'll see it again, but I don't want to keep replaying it. I actually liked what I saw from it. Just enough, something to whet the appetite.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of the opposite in a sense, because I'm the biggest Bond fan ever. I think I'm one of the biggest Bond fans ever. I'm obsessed with it in many ways. So
More than enough people that will argue that.
I'm sure I'm one of millions, but yeah, definitely. And there's a lot of us, I think, out there with Bond who are really, really into it. So I've watched this trailer ridiculous amounts of times now, and I've done my analysing of it, and I've come up with my theories, and I think that's what I really liked about it, because it would have been so easy to throw together a teaser trailer that was just basically Daniel Craig kicking a bit of ass, because I'm sure they've edited. I mean, I know they're still filming, and it's been a very tight turnaround by all accounts for Spectre, but they could have easily thrown together a few scenes of Daniel Craig skiing, being shot at, kicking someone's ass. Easily put some heavy music over it, put the Bond theme over it, bang, you're done. People would have been excited. But this teases this film on a different level in a way I haven't really seen a Bond film do. It makes it about a mystery, a central Bondian mystery, I think, even more than any of these other films have done. There's always been that sort of layered in, I think, in Craig's films to an extent. Certainly was in Skyfall. There was this underlying mystery of his parentage and his childhood, which, wonderfully, I loved about Skyfall. He never said a word about. Everything we learned about Bond came from everybody else. He never said a thing about his childhood. And that was wonderfully done. And I think that trend is going to carry on. It makes sense that Sam Mendes was so into doing this, because he's clearly doing this very much as a kind of, if not direct sequel to Skyfall, but a very much thematic continuation of that film. Because there's obvious direct links to it. You know, MI6 still has been blown up from Javier Bardem's villain. You know, Skyfall is explicitly mentioned, the fire, that directly results as part of this plot. So it's very much skewing into this. And as you say, it's tying back into Quantum from Quantum of Solace with the appearance of Jesper Christensen, which is brilliant. It's a stroke of genius, in my opinion, again. So it will tie together all of Craig's films. And if rumours are to be believed, this is part one of a two-parter, which potentially would consider... Yeah, if the rumours are true and Christoph Waltz is playing Blofeld, then Spectre potentially will roll on into maybe the next film as a threat. I mean, it would make sense, given they're tapping into the old-style, you know, continuing threat thing. Although I don't necessarily think Waltz will be Blofeld. I think there's another twist to this, yeah. But
I like the idea that if they are trying to merge everything together. I think it was the nature of these films, things kind of, you know, nature of the fact that we are in the age of what my favourite podcast, the Mamo podcast, call the mega franchise, in which we are watching franchises, but like beyond anything. So, you know, even now on Silent, there's on my screen currently is Guardians of the Galaxy, and that is the mega franchise.
Oh God, yeah.
It's Marvel, but it's not just Marvel on screen, it's the comic books, it's the TV and everything. And one of the things I like is I think they are now looking at Bond as a kind of mega franchise and actually utilizing things really well. So instead of when you hear something like Quantum of Solace, it's not just the title of the obscure book now. What they're turning around and going, there was a group called Quantum in that film. Now we have a group called Spectre. And the idea that maybe they might try and merge these things together a little bit more, I think is a decent thing. God, you know, it sounds ridiculous, and you always have to put your hand up and go, we have no idea at this moment in time. We are very lowly podcasters at this moment in time making speculations, but I do like the idea of that to be something that happens.
Definitely. It would be really nice to see that happen, because Bond certainly has the pedigree and the scope You know, it's a franchise that has never, ever lost money. In fact, it's made, the billions it's made is you know, combined more than probably any other franchise, bar maybe Star Wars, potentially. Wait, so it's...
Even Thunderball? That film's rubbish.
Well, yeah, even Thunderball, with its very boring last hour of just swimming.
I know it was the first time they ever did it, but come on.
Yeah.
Oh.
I do agree in the last era there, but yes, it's
my dad's favourite, by the way.
Oh, all dads love Thunderball. All men over 40 love Thunderball, and I think Thunderball's possibly the sexiest 60s Bond film. But only the first hour of it is really entertaining, and then it just literally drowns under its own weight, I think. But
yeah.
But yes, I think that Spectre does stand to be. You know, it's going to take a lot to really match the level of hype and excitement and genuine critical respect that Skyfall gained. But I think it's got a good chance of doing it. And I think that from what this trailer points out anyway, the essential points are there. So it will be very exciting to see that the full length trailer, I dare say, towards the middle or end of the summer. So, moving on then, we'll go back to our reviewing. And the next up, this is over to you, Les, to talk about Kenneth Branagh's Disney version of Cinderella.
I want to tell you a secret that will see you through all the trials that life can offer. Have courage and be kind.
She'll merely be your stepmother, and you'll have two lovely sisters to keep you company. So I'll know, as far away as I may be, that you'll be safe.
Wouldn't you prefer to eat when all the work is done, Ella?
Yes, stepmother.
Oh, you needn't call me that. Madam will do.
Cinderwench. Dirty Ella. Cinderella.
Yeah, so Sir Kenneth Branagh, you know, that well-known director of Peter's Friends.
Yes, his main thing.
But no, we joke. One of the reasons why he's done quite well as a director recently is because of Four, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on which viewers know what. So, but you know, Peter's Friends, Much Ado About Nothing. That was, you know, he was very more into Shakespeare, and obviously he did like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. He has turned around, and 2013 he has done a live action adaptation of Cinderella. Now we all know the story, possibly. I say we all know the story, you know, everyone knows their story depending on where they've got the source from. Now it's a Disney film, and most people have got the source from Disney, so therefore what's really happened is it's kind of like a live adaptation of that Disney film. There is moments of it that look very much like the Disney film. There is moments, there's aspects of set design that is very much from that Disney 1950s animated feature. Not a problem at all. It's, you know, that's fine. That's not an issue. I think the big thing for me as a film, something that I wouldn't really have watched at this point in time, as someone who's actually trying to limit the amount of times he goes to cinemas to watch films that he wouldn't be too interested in, it's a bit bland. It's one of these things on where you can tell that Disney have put money towards it. There is a lot of great set design and visual production in terms of what's in the, and I apologise for saying this because it's a very pretentious film term, mise-en-scène.
Mm.
But there doesn't seem to be any reason why anyone would need to watch this other than the fact that you would probably want to distract your kids for a little while. Now, the interesting thing for me currently is the last week since it's been released, I've read up on a couple of articles. Tasha Robinson for The Dissolve made an interesting article. A very strong feminist critic and friend, Marianne Johnson, has posted her review on Flick Philosopher. And their arguments are really interesting because they're coming from a very strong critical feminist point of view. I don't think this film needs that, and I'm sure that one or two people who would think differently would consider me as mansplaining, as they now say.
Mansplaining. I've not heard that one before.
Yeah. I don't see the point in arguing this sort of aspect towards something which is a certain type of traditional fairy tale. It is a live adaptation of an old 50s feature. And yes, you could turn around and say maybe it could be more subversive. I don't necessarily think that is the best way to go with something like Cinderella, necessarily. It is something to turn around, and it is a kid's fairy tale. Whether or not the message in there is a good one could be argued, but the argument of the fairy tale, the message it's trying to portray, is the idea of the courage to be nice. And maybe it's just the fact that I've worked in customer service too long, but the courage to be nice is lost on people these days.
Yeah.
So I generally think that it's not too bad. I think there's something slightly cynical from someone who's very cynical themselves, coming from a lot of critics about this, and I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I think it's not a great film because it's bland, as opposed to feminist leanings, so to speak. I could be very wrong, and I'd be happy to hold my hand up and listen to people who say otherwise, but I don't know. I think it's problematic in the same way that Snow White and the Huntsman is problematic, in which that the fairest of them all is the evil stepmother. The Downton Abbey actress, I think it's Lily White.
Lily James.
Her name is. No, sorry, Lily James. I apologise. She does a lovely, breathless kind of performance, but she doesn't really stand out in any real way. Nor does the Prince Charming, who's once again very handsome, but doesn't stand out in any way. I think the real MVP of the piece is Cate Blanchett. She's amazing.
She's always brilliant. She's great usually in things that aren't so good. You know, she elevates most things. I love Cate Blanchett. I'm a massive fan. Yeah.
What? And I think Branagh knows this.
Yeah. One thing I was going to ask actually, because I listened to Kenneth Branagh's interview on Kermode and Mayo the other day. Yeah. I don't know if you listened to it, but one of the things he said was that when he read the script originally, what was lacking was a sense of knowing, kind of winking to the audience that we're the postmodern element of knowing that this classic fairy tale and trying to do something a little bit more subversive with it. Now, is that anywhere in the finished product, do you think? Or is there any kind of, you know, feeling of that he's managed to get in there?
I don't believe so at all. I think it's a very straight-edge adaptation of the Disney version of the movie. I mean, I'll go back to what I was saying about Blanchett. I think Branagh knows the strengths, and Blanchett is so good. The first moment we see her as an evil, as the evil stepmother, it's a mid shot that turns, and she turns around, and it's almost as if they've got like a spotlight iris shot on her, and she looks like a 50s star. Now she always has had that kind of classical look about her. But, you know, she's shot under a veil, and she's got this fantastic 50s look about her. And she just doesn't go out of style in any shape or form, but, you know, there's a retro leaning to it. And she looks amazing. And that kind of continues all the way through. If this was subversive, you would have gained a lot more from Cinderella. There is a sense of urgency at times, but I don't think it's anything. It's not a. Once again, I go back to Snow White and the Huntsman, which is a film that I didn't particularly enjoy. I found it a bit joyless. But one of the things I found about the film is how they portrayed Snow White and what they did as her and placing her as a warrior with this certain sense of agency. I don't feel that's the exact same with Cinderella. She stands up for herself when she needs to stand up for herself at the point in time, but I don't think there's anything too subversive about this. I think it is made for single digit aged kids, and I find it really weird and really cynical that there's a whole bunch of adults going, well, it's not feminist enough, you know, being nice isn't good enough. And it's like, well, in all honesty, considering the age of the children it's made for, the parents can turn around and go, you know, it's a fairy tale. Deal with the fact that real life is a bit rubbish.
Tough love, yeah.
Yeah.
Cinderella is out for the next few, will be out for the next few weeks, more than likely over the Easter holidays. So that's one to take your nan, take your little one, take your girlfriend. Check it out.
I have to see her again.
Are you looking for this?
Let's briefly talk about the UK box office as of last weekend, which is interesting because it's we haven't done the box office for a few weeks actually, so we're in new territory right now. And number 10 is Statham in Wild Card, which has made a princely £52,000. To date, and considering it made something like $3,500 in America, means it's now a bomb here and abroad.
Yeah.
So that's in at number 10. Expect that to drop out fairly fast. And number 9, still clinging on in there after a month and a half. That's 50 Shades of Grey, which has made now £34 million and is closing on the £34.5 million. So it might make that before it drops out the number 10 spot.
Oh, I thought it would have made more. I also find it really interesting now that Sam Taylor Johnson has dropped out.
Yes,
the sequels, and I also find it really interesting. There's a really great Vanity Fair article that talks brief.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for, but you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
...about the making of, and you're seeing two British women. One's a writer, obviously that's E.L. James, and the director. Not so much falling out, but two completely different people coming together to try and make a movie with the fans at heart. And it's, you know, I do urge anyone that has that, you know, that, you know, I depend on this kind of podcast and the people that listen to this podcast, but I do urge people to try and find that that Vanity Fair article, because it shows you what happens when fandom and making an actual film kind of combine and come together.
Yeah, it is interesting, and it will be interesting to see how 50 Shades Darker turns out. I would bet money on the fact that Jamie Dornan is regretting his decision to star in this now. Really, I mean, it's made him a much more famous man, but not necessarily for all the right reasons. And from what I've heard, he hates Dakota Johnson with a passion, and the feeling's mutual. So I think it's going to be a very interesting sequel to, by the sounds of it, a rather uninteresting film. So Still Alice is in at number 8. Actually, it's in its third week. It's made $1.5 million. So not much, but it's at least broken the top 10, because that's a very good film that deserves applause. At number 7, Sweet Francais, which is the only second week, which is the film that Dan Taylor absolutely loved last week. He had a great time. And that's made 1.3 million. Again, that more than likely, like Still Alice, won't be around for much longer, but it's made a slight dent. At number 6, in its second week, Run All Night, the Liam Neeson film, which hasn't taken much at all. That's just made just over 1.5 million. That's been a very, very average gross by the look of it, which doesn't necessarily surprise me, because I don't really know who that's going to appeal to, except dads who like Michael Mann films, possibly. Mm. Michael Mann films done not as good as Michael Mann. Really. Yeah, because that was not a bad, it's not like Taken 3 levels of Neeson bad, but it wasn't his best at all, obviously. At number 5, in at number 5, The Gunman, which has made 405,000, which is more than it ever deserved, quite frankly, because it is enormously dull, and I think might hopefully put a lid on this Jerry action hero genre, which seems to have cropped up. At number 4, we have Focus, which is now in its 4th week, the Will Smith, Margot Robbie romantic con caper comedy drama thing, which actually has made 6.5 million. And actually, I liked Focus, even though I've heard some real slatings of it. But I thought it was fun. I thought it was a blast of fun. I thought it was Will Smith being Will Smith again and enjoying himself. So, and number 3 is the second best, very exotic, very Marigold Hotel, which we of course reviewed on the last time you were on, which has made 13.5 million, and you were absolutely right, Les, when you said that was going to do well, because it's clearly hit a chord with the older set. And, you know, as I said, I liked it. I it was harmless, nice, well-acted, amiable, fun. So I am glad that's done well. I don't think we need the third best exotic Marigold Hotel, to be quite honest, which will probably happen now.
There's a great... Commode is really pushing at this moment in time. He mentioned it on the other podcast for Radio 4, the Business of Film.
Yes, which I recommend. I've been listening to that a little bit. It's very good.
It's very good. That the idea that there is a market, the grey market, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it's funny because now everyone's kind of catching up. When I remember working at a cinema and seeing things like Ladies of Lavender make a ton of money. And, you know, because that's what happens. We are having an older generation come upon us, and they don't want to watch Guardians of the Galaxy or Marvel films or whatever the next Die Hard or whatever franchise sequels are going on. They do want to watch certain things like that, and that doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me in the slightest. I may not want to watch it. I may not find the value of it yet.
a few more years.
Exactly. But I think... It doesn't surprise me that it's making its money. I think it's really, really adamant.
It hits a chord, and you know it knows what it's going for. In a similar way, at number 2 is Insurgent, the Divergent series, and that's just going for the opposite end of the scale, but not doing it well in terms of creative filmmaking, but hitting the market well. That's in its first week. That's made 2.9 million straight away, and I dare say it will make a little bit more. Well, I don't think it will necessarily, it won't be a 50 Shades of Grey level hit, but it might make as much as Marigold Hotel has, possibly. But realistically, however, once all the kids go and see Insurgent, no one else is going to bother, because it's not for anyone else. It really isn't.
It's a very dull film.
It is a dull film. Yeah. Just not really doing anything that we haven't seen before in various other ways. And it's, like you say, just dull, just completely dull. But as I say, tapping into a market that's there and we'll watch this stuff. So it's unsurprising it's at number 2. But at number 1 to finish is Home, the animated, the animated film, which has taken 6 million straight away. And again, I didn't see Home. It wasn't reviewed on the podcast. But again, it's one for the kiddies. It will last over Easter. So it's, again, no surprise. The animated films, very rarely do they not do well, you know, which makes sense, because that, like I say, you take the little ones to see. SpongeBob SquarePants, no doubt, will do good money this weekend. But yeah, that's the box office top 10. That's where we are. Now we're going to, however, move on to another new release, which is the very low-budget Brit sci-fi robot Overlords.
People of Earth, do not be alarmed. We wish you no harm. Robots never lie.
Citizens, you have 10 seconds to return to your home. This is your final warning.
Shut!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Surrender immediately.
Robot Overlords is directed by John Wright, who did Grabbers previously.
Oh, really?
Yes, he did. He did Grabbers. Mm. Which I haven't seen, but I've heard a lot about that, actually.
Big fan of it. It was really good fun. Richard Cole's really good in it.
Well, interestingly enough, this isn't quite necessarily the same kind of thing. Robot Overlords basically set in a slightly future hence in which a robot alien race have invaded the planet and subjugated all humanity by locking them in their homes with tracking devices on their necks to the point where they're not allowed to leave. And if they do leave their homes, they will be shot by a robot that appears and gives them 10 seconds to go back indoors, and it will incinerate them otherwise. And their claim is that they are going to research humanity, and once they're finished and they find out what they want to know, they will leave. Obviously, most people don't believe them. Ben Kingsley works as a aid to the aliens in the sense of being a kind of a charitable guy who feeds the people locked in their homes and is allowed to wander about and has authorization codes to do that. He's got an A-up duck accent, and his name's Smythe. He talks like that all the way through. He's Yorkshireman, but he's the most robotic Yorkshireman ever, and it's possibly intentional, but it's yet again not a role where Ben Kingsley is just doing a silly accent and if for no other reason. It's very... It focuses around a family, which is Gillian Anderson's the mum, and there are some very young, bland things who are the kids. There is the quite sort of angry young man. Basically, the dad has disappeared years ago and seems to have been either killed or kidnapped by the aliens. His young son is, you know, quite brooding and everything. He's got his best friend. He's a joker. He's the jokey one, but the annoying one. He's got the hot sister, obviously, who that likes the other guy, and, you know, they can't go and get it on. And then there is the young lad from across the street who's orphaned because his dad went outside and went, "Come on, aliens, I'll take you all on," and gets shot for his trouble. So they take him in, and he turns out to be a bit of a whiz. It is cliche central number one, basically. And it wants to be kind of... I think I described it as EastEnders meets Battlestar Galactica in a review.
Okay.
Yeah, which it's very, very lo-fi, low budget. There's not much money involved. It's kind of... It's a bit like if you had Cylons walking around in, you know, Albert Square, really. It's all very sort of kitchen sink low, you know, like kind of, you know, dialogue. They're either Cockneys or they're Yorkshire people. And then the problem with that is, though, when you've got Gillian Anderson as the mum, it doesn't really ring true, because Gillian Anderson is now one of these actresses who, she's a bit too sort of iconic to just be a normal working class mother. You know, she's Dana Scully. She's, you know, that tart from The Fall. You know, it's like, she doesn't really do kitchen sink, Gillian Anderson. And if she does, she doesn't quite fit. She's a girl, I love her. I mean, I grew up watching that woman, and I love her to bits, but she doesn't quite fit this role. And she's not really in much of it. And it's mainly Ben Kingsley, because lo and behold, Ben Kingsley's actually a bit of a bad guy. And the kids go on a plucky mission to... Oh, yeah, shocker. The kids go on a plucky mission to try and find their dad. And in the end, you know, they discover that these alien tracking devices that, you know, monitor them can be stopped by an electrical charge, which is a bit of a surprise. No one else has figured that out, seemingly, in 3 years. It feels like a TV movie that you get on Sci-Fi that is just going through certain motions. It's got some fairly decent ideas, but and it's got a very, very, very weird use of the alien robot overlord. He's a midget, with a human face who speaks with a helium voice. And it's very odd. And he walks around, and unfortunately, John Wright clearly, like I say, didn't have any money, so he's filming it all in like very provincial sort of local sort of seaside towns and things like that, and putting in some very dodgy CGI. Mm. And it's just one of those things where you just wish that he'd have been given more money for a start, and it just had maybe been a lot less obvious, cliched, and at times, if I'm honest, quite dull. To actually worth merit, because something like this is great to see. It's great to see a British filmmaker making something. And you know, I read an interview with him not so long back, and he's gleefully admitting his influences are things like Spielberg and you know Zemeckis and all this stuff. And he wants to make these kind of British kind of style films. But I don't know if it works in a kitchen sink, realistic British way, trying to do that stuff. Or if it does, it needs a little bit more money and creativity that isn't so obvious. So I didn't really take to it, and I thought it was, to an extent, a missed opportunity, really. But he's clearly someone, if Grabbers is good, he's clearly someone who's got some talent.
Well, Grabbers works because the CGI isn't too bad, but the nature of the film kind of tends to the fact that it doesn't matter.
Mm.
It is a film in which aliens invade and they, instead of like signs where spoiler water can help destroy them,
God, don't get alcohol, me onto that.
You know, it's set in Ireland, so there's a not so much stereotypical, but we all know that there's an aspect of you go to Ireland and if you drink, people do like to drink there, in the same way that here in England people do like to drink here, and it kind of works for what it needs to work for. This looks like he's been given a bit more in terms of stars and whatnot, but I don't know, I'm not entirely sure. I don't think you really sold it for me in terms of what it's about, especially as a kids movie.
Yeah. Well, this is the whole thing. On the face of it, you'd think it's like, you know, it's that kind of Super 8 kind of thing. It's technically the kids are the leads and they're facing this bigger external threat. But with a film like that, they had the budget to really pull off the vision. And it very much did have a kind of Spielbergian feel to it. So, you know, it worked in that context and it worked in the world it was in. In this case, and the kids are entertaining. And all these films where the kids are front and centre and all your kind of Spielberg things, the kids are entertaining. In this case, they're not. You know, they're not entertaining. The problem is, as you said, Grabbers didn't necessarily need the CGI. This does. In order to realise this does really need to have some decent effects. And there are moments where it really doesn't, and you can really see it. And it just goes through the motions, and it's got a plot that is just, you've seen it before. It's cribbing from other things, and it's not nearly as fun either, or as in on the joke as it should be. You know, something like this, it's pulp B movie nonsense. You know, it's 80 minutes, so it's not very long. It should have been 80 minutes of very tongue in cheek, knowing B movie silliness, and it takes itself far too seriously quite often for its own good. So it's a shame, really, because it had more potential to be a blast of nonsense, and it's just not really that fun to sit through. Interestingly enough, it's not really been released many places. I think it's only at Vue Cinemas. So it's not out in your multiplexes. It will barely make a dent, I think, anywhere. And I think it will be quite honestly forgotten very fast, which is a bit of a shame, because it's nice to see British filmmakers trying to make things that aren't just, you know, costume dramas or things about council estates. It's nice.
urban sprawl.
Yes, it makes a change. But unfortunately, they just need a little bit more oomph and money behind them in order for it to work. So, yeah, Robot Overlords will be out. You'll be lucky to catch it anywhere. But yeah, see if you can find it if you're very much a hardcore sci-fi fan. Otherwise, wait till it's on Sci-Fi, the channel, and just watch it then.
You reckon?
Okay, let's switch gears and go back to our trailer talk. This time we're going to have a little chat about what we thought about the new trailer for the next Mission Impossible film, Mission Impossible 5, Rogue Nation.
Ready or not, Benji.
Ethan, where are you?
The Syndicate is real.
A Rogue Nation trained to do what we do.
and anti-IMF.
You want to bring down the syndicate? It's impossible.
Desperate times. Desperate measures.
Check your seatbelt on?
You have to be down now!
Oh my God!
So, did you catch this list? What did you think?
The interesting thing for me, in terms of Mission Impossible, is I just think Tom Cruise is a movie star. It sounds silly, and it sounds really obvious because we know he's a movie star. But we are now entering this, you know, world where it is quote-unquote easier to do sort of CGI stunts and to have actors who have insurance, so to speak, or have something in their contract, or maybe a double and whatnot. There is something about Cruise knowing that it's him doing things that kind of gets you invigorated again. Mm. And even though the plot isn't particularly that interesting, from what it seems like from the trailer, it's Tom Cruise doing some crazy stuff that we haven't, I'll tell you what it is. It seems like we haven't seen a movie actor do what he's doing in a long while. And I don't know what it is. I'm sure that we've watched something where there was some really good physical stunts or whatnot. But there's something about that money shot of the plane and seeing what happens in that just gets you a little bit more elevated and a little bit more excited to see what's going to happen. Plus, it's Christopher McQuarrie.
Yes.
And I'm a massive fan of Way of the Gun. So I think there's going to be some interesting things going in there.
Well, I mean, he was tapped to do Wolverine at one point, wasn't he? And he was tapped to be involved in things like that. So Chris McQuarrie is one of those guys who, you know, he's very talented and he hasn't necessarily done as many things as he should have done. And when it was announced that he was doing this, I was really buzzing because I liked Valkyrie. You know, with Tom Cruise in, that was a good film, which he did. So they've worked together before and it's worked. And I mean, Mission Impossible, I was saying this the other day, Mission Impossible for me is one of the better franchises in terms of consistency, because I think really there's only been one duff Mission Impossible film, and that was Number 2, because when they tried to make it, you know, Hong Kong cinema meets James Bond, and it just was a bit wanky, quite honestly. But the first one is a very, very good Hitchcockian style action thriller.
Well, of course it is, because it's Brian De Palma.
It's Brian De Palma, yeah, exactly. The third one is Alias the movie, and I was a big fan of Alias the TV show, and it's basically Alias the movie. And J.J. Abrams brought that style to it, so that was a lot of fun. The Ghost Protocol was great, because it, like you say, it had that money shot as well on the Burj Khalifa and all these things, and it was really sexy and dynamic and fun, you know, and Brad Bird really nailed that. So it's a series that has some really, really talented people who've directed each of these films. You know, all five have had really, really talented directors, even though John Woo didn't get it right.
It's a bit like Aliens.
Yes, yeah, basically,
They have to have someone which has a certain type of vision to things.
Yeah, and so as a franchise, it's very good, actually, and it's better than people give it credit for. So I think, and the way, again, in a similar way to Spectre, the fifth one, you know, it's tying certain things together, not necessarily from previous films, but it's bringing more of the characters who are in different films together. So now it's got Ving Rhames properly in it again, you know, even though he only had a cameo in the last one. And he's alongside like Jeremy Renner, who came into the last one, and Simon Pegg, who came in from the third one. And then you've still got your new characters like Rebecca Ferguson and Alec Baldwin and these guys. So it's nice that it's honouring the franchise that's been there for 20 years and the characters involved, while, you know, as you say, you do. I mean, the great thing about Mission Impossible is the same story almost every time. There, you guarantee there will be an IMF mole in this. There's an IMF mole in every single one, right? And in this, there will be. Or there'll be some kind of... I would put money on Alec Baldwin being the baddie at the end of this, right? Or some twist. There always will be. And that's that's going to happen with Mission Impossible. In fact, I'd be annoyed if it didn't. And, you know, so yeah, the plot looks quite derivative, you know, it looks quite obvious, but it looks fun. And that money shot, the whole point is they know exactly what they're doing with that. That's why that was at the front and centre of the trailer, him clinging onto that plane at the end. They know full well that you go into these now expecting some shit. His crew's really doing that? And that's what you get. So I completely agree in the whole thing about Tom Cruise being somebody who's really grabbing you by that. And oh God, for a man who's 50, I mean, Sean Penn was similar with The Gunman. For a man who's 50-odd, he looks bloody good. I will never look that good, and I'm 20 years younger than him. It's like, it's just not fair. But yeah, I think it's going to be really good, and I think Chris McQuarrie will do something that's not only fun, but also, you know, really kind of quite entertaining and clever for what it is. So that comes out in July, I think, because they brought the release date up, haven't they? So yeah. We'll catch it then. So that's one to look out for. Okay, finally, we have our last review of the day, which is the Will Ferrell, Kevin Hart team up, Get Hard.
James King.
Yes?
You're under arrest for fraud and embezzlement.
I have faith that the justice system will exonerate me.
I sentence you to 10 years in a maximum security prison.
Did he say 10 years?
My life is ruined. Because after 30 days, I'm going to prison.
It's not as bad as I've heard, is it?
Hell yeah, it's bad.
Teach me how to survive in prison the way you did.
Tell me how you know I went to prison.
Given your low economic status.
Wait, what?
Your perceived lack of college education.
Lack of, okay.
Statistically, you definitely went to prison.
I'll see you tomorrow, convict.
Now, I want to tell you a little story, Les, about when I went to this film. Okay. I went to this film, and all the way there, I'd been laughing at the title and thinking, did they know they were calling the film Get Hard? Now, as it turns out, they did. They fully were in on the joke in the film. But because I'm a very witty and urbane and sophisticated man, I went up to the cashier as I went to the cinema. You know what's coming. I went there. I went to the cashier and I said, I'd like to get hard, please. And I laughed in my head. I know exactly. I laughed in my head. I put it on Facebook, at which point Matt Latham, who's a contributor, said, yes, they probably heard that 50 times in that day and thought you were a prick. And I was like, yes, they more than likely did. And I knew that, and I still laughed. And he looked at me and did that kind of chuckle as if to say, knob. And then and I went in there, and I laughed more at that joke that wasn't funny that I did than anything in that film. Because it's no surprise to say that it's not very good. We're not talking unfinished business levels of bad, okay, in terms of just a graveyard of comedy. But what unfinished business wasn't was offensive and hot and nasty. And Get Hard is at times. Because it's two central jokes. Because the whole story is Will Ferrell's this investment banker, super rich, getting married to Alison Brie, who looks fucking brilliant in this, admittedly, but she's a bitch. She's like a rich bitch, marrying him for his status and his money. And then he gets framed, basically, which is no shocker to reveal. Gets framed for embezzlement or something like that. And he's sent to prison for 10 years. But he has 30 days to get his affairs in order. So because he realises he's terrified of prison, he gets Kevin Hart, who's this basically just a car wash valet guy who needs money in order to, you know, make more of his life. He's got kids. He's married. And because he's black, Will Ferrell assumes that he's been in prison. So Kevin Hart, when he offers to pay him like 30 grand to train him up for prison, he accepts it. So he has to blag his way knowing how to be a prisoner in order to train Will Ferrell. So one of the jokes centers on the fact that because he's a black man, he's a criminal, right? Which offends me anyway, even as a white man, right? Okay, he does. And then the other joke is that his terror is getting anally raped in prison. And he's terrified of being gay and homosexuality. So the two things that this film is taking a joke at is, you know, racism and homophobia. Now, call me a big old-fashioned stick in the mud, right? And somebody who has no sense of humour. But I'm sorry, I don't really find that funny. And, you know, this whole thing coasts on... The only people who are going to like this film are people who like Will Ferrell's usual man-child kind of thing, right? Which sometimes is good, sometimes is not good at all. And Kevin Hart, who he's crafting his own little niche somewhere between Eddie Murphy and Chris Tucker, you know. And I don't always like him in the films he's done, but he's better in this than I've seen him in The Wedding Ringer or Bride Along, which I saw him recently. I liked him more in this. And he does have potential to be a much, much better in Better Things. But I laughed a couple of times. I'll confess that, I did. But most of the time I was just sitting there thinking, this is just really, really wrong. And I wonder what you'd have thought, to be honest, Les.
Well, my issue is, there's been lots of talk. I've avoided Get Hard.
You've not got hard?
For many reasons. No, not at all. and one of the reasons why is I find Kevin Hart to be, he's not too bad in terms of his stand-up, but he doesn't seem to be a presence on cinema that I'd be quite interested in. Mm. It's interesting that you say to me that he kind of fits between the niche of of something like Eddie Murphy, because ultimately what seems to have happened since the rise of Eddie Murphy, and even to a point Richard Pryor, but even Richard Pryor kind of branched out a lot more, is just this, the idea of a certain type of black comedian and a certain type of black comedian comedy in terms of their films. Now, I think it's really interesting that you bring up the point that, yeah, because Kevin Hart is black, therefore he needs to be a thug. This is something that I've always find kind of dryly amusing in my own life. Because, of course, you know, being black, obviously these things happen. And also this is coming along at the same time that Trevor Phillips has decided that, you know, he's going to tell the truth about race. And when it comes to violent crime, it mostly goes to black people. And yes, he's got the facts, hasn't he? Because he's got these stats that are kind of swayed towards maybe inner city London as opposed to people as a whole. This doesn't surprise me. It doesn't. I don't find it that interesting. I find it helps try and push, instead of taking a mick out of stereotypes, I think it pushes stereotypes. I don't find it very. I remember watching the trailer. I don't find it very subversive. I'm not surprised that there's people such as yourself who are watching the movie and not find it very funny. I think they kind of missed the point of what could be funny about it, even though, of course, you know, comedy is very subjective. I always get really, I won't say annoyed, but I always get really frustrated with this sort of thing, because obviously what seems to happen is with your Wayans Brothers movies, late Wayans Brothers as opposed to early Wayans Brothers and the like, you see the same things being reiterated again and again and again. It's never that interesting. One thing Get Hard does, and it looks like it tries to do well in terms of the trailer. Once again, I can only speak from the trailer. But one thing it looks to try and do well is turn around and say that Kevin Hart is not that kind of stereotypical person that you always see. But on the flip side, he has to be that stereotypical person. And it just kind of falls into very simple, obvious traits. You know, even the poster is of, you know, Kevin Hart cornrowing his hair.
Yeah.
And it's just like cornrowing Will Ferrell's hair. And for me, this stuff just gets dull. I have no problem with black people being villains or, you know, criminals or anything else like that. But we need to see more complexity, more agency, and, you know, more when it comes to diversity, it needs to be more interesting in that sense, as opposed to, okay, well, we're just going to put Kevin Hart in a whole bunch of things where he does things that we all kind of think that we know people think about black people in terms of criminal and hip-hop and everything else. I find it dull.
Well, it's... well, yeah, and so you should. It's the cheapness of it that annoys me, really. It's the... Ethan Coen, who directed it and wrote it, he, again, I read something with him a while back, and he said... One of the things he said was this was really going to push the comedic envelope and be really subversive, and, you know, they were shocked by the kind of things they were making. Now, A, it doesn't do that. What... I'm not offended because I was shocked by anything, you know. It's tasteless and crass. You know, there's one shot of a very large, almost erect penis, you know, and things like that, but very briefly shot. Yeah. And everyone went, oh, but it's like, it's not shocking in that sense. It's shocking. It's offensive in the sense of the fact that it's so cheap and lazy. And on the one hand, it's trying to convince you that it's subverting all these stereotypes, but it's playing into them quite obscenely at the same time, just to get a laugh. Like Will Ferrell dressing up as Lil Wayne in order to, you know, ingratiate himself with a black crew, right? And going there and doing all the yo cracker and all this stuff kind of thing. And then you've got one scene where Kevin Hart's trying to train him up in a prison yard, right, which is basically erected around his tennis court. And he's playing different roles and playing out a scenario of three things. He's an angry black guy, right? And then he switches to be angry Mexican, homie. What are you saying, man? And he pulls his hat over his head. And he's like, what are you doing, man? What are you doing? My name's Carlos. And then on the other hand, he then turns into the little gay prison guy who you may have seen Prison Break, where he latches onto the guy's pocket and he pulls his pocket from inside out and he holds him and he goes, you're my bitch now. I'll leave him alone and all this. So he does all three of them in this 5-minute sequence. And Will Ferrell's in the middle going, I don't know what's going on. And you're there going, well, this is exactly the problem, right? This is exactly the kind of stereotype that people believe and play into and think exists out there. And this is doing nothing to stop that. And it didn't make me laugh. It just annoyed me. And it made me think, I just fundamentally disagree with the messages that this gives across. It's one thing to be, you know, politically incorrect, because that has its place and it can be funny, right, when it's done properly. But there's no satire in this. There's no element of, oh, we're making a point. This is just, isn't a, you know, entitled 50-year-old white man pretending to be black funny? Isn't Kevin Hart being a down-on-his-heel black guy, obviously being a criminal, funny? No, it's not. Mm. That's the point. And yes, like I said, there were a few cheap moments that I laughed beside myself, quite honestly. I was annoyed that I laughed. I was like, I don't like I laughed at that, but I did. But no, it's just lazy. It's lazy and it's dull, like you said, and it's crass. And it's fodder for the masses. It's the kind of thing that most people will laugh at because they don't think about the underlying point of the whole thing. They don't think of the underlying social conscience that something like this doesn't have. I don't recommend it. I think it's cheap and crass. And I think Will Ferrell's certainly done better. And Kevin Hart is capable of better. So, you know, Get Hard will be out for a while. You know, check your own conscience as to whether you're not or not you go and see it is my advice.
As your incarceration expert, this is my job to prepare you.
We are about to simulate a prison riot.
That was intense, right?
Actually, I feel fine.
Oh!
What?
You got a role, Mayo.
Who's Mayo?
It's my gang name. It's short for mayonnaise.
And that's about it. We're all done this time round, so it just leaves me to thank Les for coming on, even though he's felt a bit worse for wear, so I do appreciate it, thank you.
That's not a problem. I've really enjoyed it today, so yeah, all good.
Lovely. You can find Les on Twitter at Afro Film Viewer, and I believe you have a website as well, don't you, Les?
Yes, www.afrofilmviewer.com.
Lovely. He puts up regular reviews and, you know, film pieces on there. So it's very much worth a read, I recommend. So do follow us on Twitter, as ever, Black Hole Cinema. I am Black Hole Writer. Give us a follow. Feedback, anything you want to say about the podcast. Talk about anything we've mentioned. Any recommendations for what you want to see in the future. As always, just let us know. Drop us a note. Next week, we will be having, for our sins, a Fast and Furious special episode in which we'll be going through all the Fast and Furious films leading up to the bonkers-sounding Fast and Furious 7. So that should be a ride. Yeah?
Oh, God.
Thank you for that. Thanks for that contractual laugh, Les. So, thank you very much for listening. Thanks again to Les.
No problem.
And we'll see you soon.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.